went to Los Angeles, and my wife was managing Black Sabbath, and I got fired. I just thought, that's it, it's all over. I went down to a hotel called the Park Hotel on West Nile in LA. I pulled the drapes. A drug dealer delivered drugs on a daily basis for 3 months. I never opened the drapes for 3 months. I never saw the light of day for 3 months. I locked myself in. So Sharon says to me, I want you to go into the boardroom, take these two doves and throw them up in the air as a peace offering. So I threw one up in the air and I said, this chick sitting on my lap, and I bit the head off the thing and threw the carcass on the table. They absolutely freaked. Hi, this is Ozzy Osbourne in the studio for the making of Blizzard of Oz.
With his worldwide fame, induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with the iconic heavy metal band Black Sabbath, which he fronted in the 70s, with decades of stadiums filled from Manhattan to Moscow, and with his MTV series of selfie home invasions called The Osbournes, making him and his wife Sharon into some kind of 21st century Ozzy and Harriet, our guest today, Ozzy Osbourne, in the studio, could not possibly have imagined any of it when his first solo album, The Blizzard of Oz, finally came out in America after being held up for a full 6 months. Turns out that adversity, with a slim chance of beating all odds, was what young John Osbourne faced practically since growing up in the tough industrial northern English city of Birmingham.
Well, I was born and raised in Aston, Birmingham. My father worked in a factory. My mother worked in a factory. I have three older sisters and two younger brothers. We lived in a very small, tiny house. No money. Arguments all the time. My father would work himself to death to keep the money coming in. Very bleak, very drab. In my heart of heart, I was a dreamer. I was always dreaming. I used to think, well, wow, wouldn't it be great if my dad was to win the lottery? He wouldn't have to go to work. We could have a better house. We could have a better... And I was always dreaming for a better life. And I suppose through my dreams, I became what I became. And how I became what I became was I thought, there's got to be a way out of this. And, you know, I did a lot of soul searching, a lot of praying, a lot of hoping. And there was two choices, either go criminal... And when I heard the Beatles, I thought, that's it, man. That's what I got to be. I got to be a Beatle. I have to be a Beatle. Because when I heard the Beatles and I saw all that mayhem and all that recognition, that because at school, I never achieved anything. Academically, my leaving slip said, John Osborne has been a pupil at this school since 1961. That was it. That was what I was left to go into the world and try and survive with. It was like two lines, you know?
What's the future of?
Self-explanatory. People look to me and say, "Is the end near? When is the final day? What's the future of mankind? Don't ask me. I got left behind." It's so self-explanatory in the respect that it's like, you don't ask me because I don't know. You know, it's I'm in essence as confused as you are. You know, no, but I mean, it's not that you. I mean, you can never ask too much of a performer because that's what we're here. I look at ourselves as like your living Valium, if you like. You go to a concert and you either relate to it or you don't. If you don't relate to it, you don't like it. And I mean, the problem that I'm having and which I've always had with music is people. You can't like them because it's not fashionable. You can't. Why do you like Saturday Night Fever? Why do you like, you know, it's, you know, it's hokey. I mean, the way I look at music, I look at it all across the board. I like some Peter Gabriel. I like some I like most of the Beatles stuff. I like some Stones. I like some Zeppelin. I like some Pearl Jam. I like some Alice in Chains. But some of it I don't, you know. But because it's all but in pigeonholes, and it's groovy to like this alternative or whatever the hell they call it nowadays. It's too many of these. I mean, like in the old days in the 70s, you'd get bands like the Eagles, Yes, and Sabbath doing the same gig, you know. Or you'd get we opened up for James Taylor one time, you know. Yeah. But you see that's the whole thing in the old nowadays. It's like these metal packages, these rap packages, these alternative packages. And to be totally honest with you, Redbeard, when Headbangers Ball, I couldn't watch it because it's too much. It's and I'm called heavy metal, but and in its day, it went from Poison, Bon Jovi, Aerosmith, Ozzy, Motorhead, Metallica. We were all called heavy metal. Now we're nothing like each other whatsoever, you know, musically. And but because we're branded as heavy metal and we got tattoos, it's just, I don't know. Music is music. You either like a certain form of music or you don't. what happened with me and Black Sabbath was it got. I mean, it became at the beginning we all had a purpose, but as it went along, that inevitable thing stepped in called ego. And to get four guys to come up with the same result at the end of the day was near on impossible, because not saying I was better than them, not saying they were better than me, not saying any of us were any better than anybody else, but the fact is that success does change you. I mean, when you're hungry, you all have one goal to have, and that is to get successful. Now, when you get successful, it affects various people. I mean, it affected me. I didn't give a shit. I was full of cocaine and all the rest of the crap that I used to do, you know? So, I mean, that stuff makes you talk like a total horse crap, you know? There shouldn't be a problem in the world, because I think we solved them all in a bathroom of a hotel with a bag of that white powder, you know? I mean, it's bullshit powder, you know? It's just nothing. And then we were working and working. I mean, in actual fact, one of the things that when I met Rick Wakeman, he said, because they used to tour a lot with Sabbath, and Rick says to me, he says, "Man," he says, "do you remember what you guys used to do? You were never off the road, man. You were never stopped. You never stopped for and we were just out of our minds, just doing it every night for years, you know." Hi, this is Ozzy Osbourne in the studio for the making of Blizzard of Oz. What happened was I was getting musically frustrated because, you know, there's one of the songs that I'm just a backstreet kid, one that we wrote. And there's a line that I wrote on there. It says, rock and roll, what is it? Rock and roll is paying my lawyer's bills or something like that. Now my rock and roll is paying off my legal fees. I can't remember exactly what the line was. But we were working on the road to pay lawyer's fees to keep the lawsuit going against the manager that was ripping us off. And I just said, hey, man, I didn't start this. I didn't say it out to the guy. I was thinking, well, I didn't get involved in this to become a damn lawyer. I don't know the first. I don't understand the business side of it. I don't want to. I understand you got to do this and that and whatever. That's my wife does that now. Now it seems my music's paying off my tax demands. That's the line. And we'd never paid tax, so we had to pay tax and all this and whatever. I said to the band one day, I said, you know, I want to do a solo album. And they said, Tony said to me, well, we're a band. I said, yeah, but I'd like to do something on my own, you know. And they, you know, it's all for one and one for all, as you know, the scene, you know, whatever you've got, you should put into the band. And two of the songs that I wrote got on, Who Are You and Am I Going Insane, I wrote those. But I was still wanted to do something. I wanted to do something aside from Sabbath. Not saying that I was any better than Sabbath, because Sabbath, in my opinion, from 1968 till after I left with the two Dio albums involved, was one of the greatest bands I ever worked with. But I just had this thing that I had to vent my thing and do something. What I wanted to do, you know? So I said to Tony, and he says, well, if you've got any ideas, you should put them to the band, because we're a band, you know? It'd be great if I come up with something and didn't give it to you guys. And then I said, oh, fair enough, then okay. What do you think about this? Don't like it. What do you think about this? Don't like it. What do you think about this? Don't like it. What do you think about this? And so on. And I didn't like anything. So here am I. I'm still frustrated. I don't like what I've done. They said, tell me that if I've got any ideas, you should give to the band. I've given them to the band. They don't like it, so I'm still in the same hole. But now I'm more frustrated because I've got this desire to do a solo album, and so I left. I just thought, this is crap, you know. That wasn't the reason why I left. It was because that we would write a song, book a studio and try and finish the album in a studio, which is just total crap to me, you know. I don't like being in a studio. I mean, I got the rap of being stoned and drunk all the time. You know, I wasn't the only one, man. I mean, we were all in a bad way, man, with drugs and alcohol, a very, very bad way. You know, and that powder makes you talk the biggest crock of shit on the planet, you know. And so... Well, when I left and then I went back again, and then when we did Never Say Die, I just thought, well, for whatever it's, you know, I can't go on anymore. I wasn't really putting anything in because I was just like, I thought, well, okay, it's either this or get a day job, you know. And this is better than a day job, you know. At least I don't have to get up and do a job and see people that I don't really... I mean, if I don't want to see the band, I could stay in my room all day. And most of the times, I'd hang around with the road crew anyway and just get drunk and stoned every day. And so, eventually, we went to Los Angeles, and my wife and her... when she had Jet Records with her father, was managing Black Sabbath, and I got fired. And then I just thought, that's it, it's all over. I went down to a hotel called the Le Parc Hotel on West Nile in LA. I pulled the drapes. I had a drug dealer deliver drugs on a daily basis for 3 months. I never opened the drapes for 3 months. Booze from a Gil Turner's was delivered every day. My room was like an empty, full of cans of beer and old eaten pizzas and everything and drugs. I never saw the light of day for 3 months. I locked myself in. And then one day Sharon come around and she said, well, first of all, somebody came around and said, hey, Don Arden's come up with this idea of Dio does one night and you do the next night. I says, kiss my ass, you know. So then he comes around and he says, Ozzy, I want you to go out in a band. I want you to call your band the Son of Sabbath. And I says, you're stoned. You know, well, take another hit. Go away. So then Sharon comes around and says, listen, we've let Sabbath go. If you clean yourself up, we want to get you a band. And I thought, my at that point, my self-worth was zero. I never saw daylight for 3 months. Never saw I never saw a car. I never saw fresh air. I never smelled any. I was just in this box doing drugs and drinking alcohol because I thought, well, this is it. I'm over, finished. It's all over. I might as well just go with it, you know. Because I hadn't, I mean, after being on that, being one extreme to going right back to where you started from, it's got to be a terrible shock to reality. Because I knew for a long while that I had a drink problem. I knew I had a very bad drink problem, but I was in a kind of denial. I mean, the way I would go, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Give me a drink, you know. And Suicide Solution was like me singing about me, you know. Wine is fine, but whiskey's quicker. Suicide is slowly liquor. It was not about, you know, kill yourself. It's cool. Listen, man, if that was the case, it would be a very bad career move. You know, you buy the record, shoot yourself. The follow-up record wouldn't sell many, would it? And then I through different people, I mean, I'd never auditioned anybody in my life, so I didn't know how to audition. So Sharon set up these auditions, and then as it went along, I was married to another woman at the time. But I suddenly found myself feeling more than just a manager relationship with my wife. I hadn't hit up on her, but I just fell in love with my manager, you know. I mean, because she was so caring, she was so understanding, and she took a lot of the heat off, you know, and she was very protective towards me. And she also had no thing on me, you know, and it was just, I just turned around to her one day and I just said, you know what? I said, I think I'm falling in love with you. And she said, what? She says, are you stoned? I says, no. I says, you know, I don't know. It's kind of like a heavy metal love song. So I was get the violins out at this point. And that was it. And then I met Randy Rhodes. Some guy says, I'd gone out on a bender and I'd come back. Some guy says, you've got to see this guy. So I got into this studio. I think it was Dana Strum from Slaughter. You know him, Dana Strum? So Dana says, come around this studio. I've got this great guitar player. And I was three sheets to the wind, you know. I was like in a coma. So he drags my butt down to this studio. And I go, pulls my head back, and in the studio there's this little I thought I was dreaming, like a doll, like a little mannequin with long blonde hair playing this guitar, and I said to myself, if this is not a dream, he's got a gig. If it is a dream, I'll be pissed off, because, you know. So it was just like that, and I went back to England, and I left my ex-wife. I lived in a house with Randy for about 18 months, 2 years. Then we went and we met Bob Daisley and Lee Kerslake. And we just had that was so much fun, man. We had so much, we were goofing around, practical jokes, having a laugh, like the good old days again it was, that I'd so missed with the early days of Sabbath. You know, the early part of the success is so much fun, because the first two Sabbath albums were great fun because it was all new. And then I do it with Blizzard and Diary. It was all new and we all had such a laugh, man. You know, and then all of a sudden it becomes deadly serious and people start telling you what you should and shouldn't be doing and what. And it's always the big, I mean, and if anyone is listening to this, you know, if you're new, you crack the egg, man. You enjoy those first few years of them because, you know, you never recapture them again. You know, I've been very lucky, man. ACDC are great guys. I mean, I don't see them very often, but whenever I'm in the shit or in trouble, that always, I don't know why, Malcolm calls my wife up and sees that he can do anything, and I love him for that, man. He's always helped me. I've worked with him and whatever. I knew Bon, not great, but I knew him to talk to, you know. And I went to Stafford Bingley Hall near Birmingham in England just shortly before he died, and I was in the dressing room, and they were working like around the clock, 365 days a year, and he was hitting he was doing like a lot of booze, you know. And before he went on stage, he had about a half pint glass, and I thought it was Coca-Cola, and he just slugged it down. And I said to him, he's roadie, Evo. He's a very dear friend of mine. They're roadie. In actual fact, Evo was with me at the hospital when my father passed away. He came to the hospital with me. And I said to Evo, why is he pulling all them fires? What's the matter with him? He said, it's Jack. He just downed like a half pint of Jack before he went on stage. And I said to Evo, the guy's going to, it can't last, man. I mean, that's, you know, I'm drunk telling him that this guy's got a problem, you know. And so a couple of weeks later, my sister phones me up and says, do you know this band AC/DC? I says, yeah. She says, the singer's just died. I says, oh, you got it wrong. She didn't read it to me. And she says, she read it. I was absolutely shocked, you know. But not surprised, but then I was just as bad. But then it's like, you never think, you always think, I know he was going to go, but it'll never happen to me. It kind of was the first light that went on in my head that eventually would, after years of trying to stop and start again and stop and start again, that eventually that I would, it's not a problem for me now. I really don't miss it at all anymore. Well, what happened was, for a period of time, there was this, within the rock, Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin and all this, there was this black magic, this occult thing going on. I've never been involved in the occult whatsoever. And I had a roadie that used to work for me, for Sabbath, then he went to work for Zeppelin. And Jimmy Page had given him a book about Aleister Crowley, because Jimmy Page had bought Aleister Crowley's house. And I keep hearing his name, Aleister Crowley, and I never read anything about him. And all that was about was who were you? What were you about? Where did you go? It was like this name that I didn't know much about. And then all of a sudden, it's self-explanatory. Mr. Crowley, what went on in your head? Mr. Crowley, did you talk to the dead? Your lifestyle to me was so tragic with the thrill of it all. It's just self. There's no, you don't have to be a brain surgeon to understand. But all of a sudden, I'm a can of worms, because I had no idea there is a society called the Crowley Society, still exists. Then they were saying I was pronouncing the wrong name wrong. I got threatening letters that how dare I mock their god or all this shit, you know. I mean, I at this point, I had no respect for the people in the industry whatsoever. I had such a bad scene with Warner Brothers. They didn't even send us a thank you note, and they didn't even acknowledge that we were on the label. They just put the record out and forgot about it. They didn't do anything for us. So I was a pretty anti-industry, you know. I mean, not bitter. I just thought, I'll screw you, you know. I mean, I just didn't like it. Yeah, okay, bitter, right. So Sharon says to me, we've got to make an impression here. She said, I want you to go into the boardroom, take these two doves and throw them up in the air as a peace offering. So I drank a bottle of booze in the morning and I said, I'll make an impression. So I'm standing in a line, and I'm in a line of new artists waiting to go into this boardroom. And everyone that goes in, they put their record on and they'll pretend they enjoy the record and whatever, you know. And I just got sick to my stomach of it. In front of me was a black guy, a soul singer, who had a great voice, but mad. But it was from country and western folk, soul, blues, Aussie, and every time we went into this boardroom, they'd put your record on and they'd be saying they like the record, you know, not, you know, they're into it. And I got this chick sitting on my lap, so I threw one up in the air and I said, "How do you like this?" And I bit the head off the thing and threw the carcass on the table. They absolutely freaked. Sharon threw all the contracts in the air and ran. She just freaked out, man. Within 24 hours, I was getting lawyers' letters. I was getting people said, don't ever bring this man in the building again. But hey, man, I woke a few people up and I made a few people turn their heads and say, maybe someone's with this guy, you know. It wasn't a planned thing. I didn't go, I'm going to go, I'm going to get two doves, I'm going to go down there. I just did it on the... most of the things, including that bat... Well, let's get onto that thing next. A bat thing, it's just a spontaneous... I don't go, you throw the bat on in the third song, I'll pick it up and bite it. I mean, I'm crazy, but I'm not that crazy, you know? I mean, These things happened, you know, and it's. And then I urinated up the Alamo, and then I got arrested for that. And that there was a period of time that I was just getting. I mean, I remember going to Boston, and they had a roadblock on the freeway, and they said, "Look, we can't guarantee your safety. We want you to go in, do the show," and they gave me a whole long list of what to do and what not to do, and so. I went in, did the show, and had to leave, you know. I really shook the blanket for a while, you know.
Ozzy Osbourne's Crazy Train unscheduled stop was so shocking that to this day, at least one otherwise reputable rock reference book questions the veracity of the allegations and Osbourne's confession, preferring to attribute the whole incident as hype and urban myth instead of alcoholism, which was consuming Ozzy.
Like with this bat incident, for instance, that was just a total fluke. That was just, I thought it was a rubber bat that somebody threw on. I just did it for a thing. It was a real bat.
You kind of had to pay the price for that fluke,
didn't
you?
But the thing is, it went from a bat to a goat, from a goat to a pig, from a pig to an elephant, you know.
Oh, really?
I mean, thank God there's no dinosaurs still roaming the earth.
Song You Looking at Me Looking at You that didn't fit back in the days of vinyl records when Blizzard of Oz was first released in the UK in September 1980. Still to come, Ozzy Osbourne on why he still performs Black Sabbath songs in concert, and he shares rare live performances from the Blizzard tour featuring the late Randy Rhoads. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Ozzy Osbourne for the 40th anniversary of Blizzard of Oz.
Welcome back in the studio. I'm Ozzy Osbourne with Redbeard. There's two bass players, in my opinion, that are the greatest bass players that I've ever worked with. One I have working with me now, Geezer Butler, and Bob Dazer. He is an excellent, excellent bass player. He's a... You see, you get these guys that look the part, they got all the spandex, the shit, but and they do all the shapes, but they can't play. Bob and Geezer play their instrument like nobody else. I mean, they're both great bass players, and I mean great. But Lee Kerslake was a good guy, a good drummer. But I can't have any problems, man. If I'm sick, I go on stage. If I'm not sick, I go on stage. I've got to get on with the gig, man, you know? But it's these guys. I mean, I remember with Bob and we hadn't done anything, and we were running. We hadn't done any gigs. We'd done the two albums, so we were in debt for the albums. So we had to recoup that money. I mean, I just thought, oh well, I'll do my album. If it don't happen, it don't happen. If it does, it does. And then Sharon came up with a great idea. She said, "We're not going to open up for anybody. We're going to start as we mean to finish. We're going to headline small gigs." And I said, "Fair enough." So she put the Palladium on sale in New York. It sold out in a heartbeat. And she said, "I can't believe this." So and the record hadn't been released yet. And she said, "They want to put another show on." So I said, "Fine, great, do another show." And we got to get rocking and rolling. We had nothing. We had zero cash, nothing. So there was a group meeting, and I said, "Okay, some of the band members, I'm not going to mention any names, said, well, if we do two shows, we want two lots of per diems." And I said, "Hey, man, what are you talking about, man? We ain't got enough to pay one damn, what are you talking about?" Per diems, for people that don't understand what they are, is what you get for like, it's a tax-deductible thing that you get, a living allowance for the day. You get it for a gig, you know? Which is kind of something to do with the tax or something. It's like $110 or something, you know. But and so I said, and that was a sign to me that I ain't gonna get very far with this if I got every 5 minutes. I'm more interested in what the financial gains are before they even deliver the goods, you know.
Are you ready to rock and roll?
You turn around me, guys.
I mean, when I left Black Sabbath, I said, that's it. I'm not doing any more Black Sabbath stuff. I'm going to do all my own stuff. But then the kid said to me, hey, man, we want to hear Paranoid. We want to hear this. We want to hear that. And then I stopped and thought about it. And I thought, well, you did sing on it. You did co-write it. And so it is a part of you. You're not exactly covering songs. And so, like, I mean, now I do it. I do a set of... because I've been sick, I've been cutting the set down somewhat, but a usual set, I do some old, some new, some not so old, some very new, some... I mean, I met a guy the other day at an in-store. He saw me, he showed me a ticket from 1971, and that's when he discovered me and my music with Black Sabbath, and so he's locked onto that era, and he may not like the any of the other stuff, but he locked on for me for that period. So I owe it to all my fans to play a little bit of my whole career, you know. So I mean, because if I went on stage and I said, right, I'm not doing anything else but Osmosis, people don't know it yet, you know. So they're gonna go, how can they relate? I mean, and because I've been around so long now, the kids sing along with me, you know. Well, Rudy Starzo had been with Randy in Quiet Riot. He wasn't exactly the greatest bass player, but he was okay. Tommy Aldridge was a great drummer. I'd always had a desire to work with him from the Black Oak Arkansas days, and we just went on the road. It worked out fine. We lived literally on those early two on that early tour from hand to mouth. I used to have a briefcase with a handcuff tied to my. We used to stay in them really, really cheap, sleazy Holiday Inns on the freeways with no safety deposit box. So I'd carry the cash with me, and I'd have it handcuffed to me in bed with me, you know. Yeah.
I mean, when you fly first class, when you have caviar, when you have champagne, I mean, caviar's like eating fucking fish's nuts, man. But it's caviar, man, and like, it's what posh people eat, you know. I mean, we were used to, like, Spam sandwiches or something. Let's go crazy on the crazy train! Okay, you guys upstairs, let's go! Come on! We'll be right back.
From the Blizzard of Oz tour, 1981. That's Ozzy Osbourne with the truly impressive Randy Rhoads on lead guitar. Going off the rails on a crazy train, included now on the 40th anniversary two-disc edition of Blizzard of Oz. I'm Redbeard, thanking my guest Ozzy Osbourne and sending him prayers in his battle with Parkinson's disease. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, @RedbeardRocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.